Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
Welcome to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast dedicated to all things sci-fi, fantasy, and much, much more. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 341 of the Earth Station 1 podcast. That's right, folks, we are here to talk all about Monster Men, the people that brought us the monsters to life. It's pretty cool, actually, if you think about it. The guys who are behind the, you know, the and the and the, I want to suck your blood. It's actually pretty fun to see the people that were actually behind them and the legends. And, you know, in Hollywood, there's always been, you know, the mystique of who were the Monster Men. And we got a great crew to talk about it. And speaking of a great crew, let's welcome our host for this week, Mr. Mike Gordon.
Howdy.
How are you, sir?
I could have been a Monster Man. I was actually in a performance a long time ago. I was in a community theater. I did. I was in a version of Jekyll and Hyde, and I played. I was not one of the leads. I played one of his friends, and I got horrible reviews. And it's the last thing I've ever done on stage. No, it was actually really fun. Whether it's stage, screen, TV, what have you, I love, there's nothing that beats a good performance, by a great actor, and some really, really great actors have played the roles. I mean, you won't see them, you know, getting Oscars, for this stuff, but it's a challenge and a special type of challenge. And it takes a very, I think, imaginative and special type of actor to pull these off. And we've been really, just graced with so many great ones over the years. So it's going to be fun to talk about.
Very cool. And we also have joining us once again this week, Mr. Mark Maddox.
Well, thank you guys for having me on. This is my last episode for the Halloween season.
And has it been fun for you?
Yes. It's our tradition to do this every year, and it matters a lot to me. Try to give out the facts as best I can. I'm not perfect. Maybe there's one or two little mistakes I make, but I tried to, make it so many people take away some information that they might not have known. But I love doing this, so thank you very much.
Absolutely, it's great to have you on in October. I think is this the third year we've done this?
Third or
maybe,
fourth?
Third or fourth, maybe. So yeah.
They all blend together to me.
I know, right?
It's and like last week.
And you know what? We still haven't run. I mean, every time we do one of these subjects, so like we're going to do in a little bit, obviously we don't have time to cover it all. So, you know, there's going to be plenty of stuff, topics and stuff for us to talk about next year. It's just, you know, it's just never ending, which is great. I don't want it to end.
Well, one thing I would say to people that if, you know, we do a particular subject and they're like really don't feel, you know, they feel like they want more. Like, I mean, if I was listening to this, I would want to know more if I was, you know, didn't know much about it. But there are plenty of good books by good scholars out there, the Tom Weavers and the David Skalls and stuff like that, that do such a good job with this. And they're not just informative. They're very entertaining. So, you know, if you get somebody on the road, started on the road to this, you know, it's easy to get up to Amazon and find a lot more stuff that deals with these subjects.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, because every person that we're going to mention, I'm sure, has at least one, two biographies written about
them. Yeah, and a lot more than that, buddy.
No joke. Very cool.
That is awesome, my friends. Cool. So we're going to have a great episode. And of course, we want to hear from you guys. Please write us at esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. Okay, let's get started with this week's Rants and Raves, where we find out what's on our minds. Mike, we've had some pretty sad news this week, actually.
Yeah, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because we have a lot of more festive stuff to talk about. But I did want to make note of two, at least in my for me personally, two losses that I was very shocked and sad to learn about this weekend. And one is the comedian Kevin Meaney, who, I know he's probably not a huge name among a lot of people. Some people may not even know who he is, but this is a guy that I grew up with because in the 70s and 80s, it was the time of the stand-up, right? And everybody, it was very difficult for a lot of stand-ups to, differentiate themselves. Of course, there was Jerry Seinfeld and stuff like that, but for me, I never actually saw him live, but every time Kevin Meaney was on the Tonight Show or every time he did an appearance, I made sure I tuned in. Sure, a lot of times it was the same routine, but he just always managed to make me laugh. Not just smile, not just kind of go, I like that, but really like laugh. A lot of catchphrases that he came up with, I still use almost on a daily basis.
That's not right.
Exactly. Go upstairs and put your big pants on. I just dug him. And it's what's really sad is that one of my best friends just saw him in Boston or in Massachusetts perform about a month ago. And I was asking him all sorts of questions like, how was he? Does he do some of the old stuff and all that sort of stuff? And he was talking about how fun the show was. And I made a decision right there and then that if Kevin ever came anywhere close to Atlanta, that I was not going to miss him. I was going to see him live if that was the thing that I wanted to do on the bucket list, whatever. Now I'll never get that chance, and I'm just really sad that we lost that talent. So,
Kevin was mostly known for his stuff on the Tonight Show, but he was also Uncle Buck on TV.
He did actually have a turn at that. I think that was only like one season.
Yeah, it was canceled after the first season.
I don't think it was very good. I mean, acting wasn't his strong point, I think. Stand-up really was.
Mm-hmm. He was also in Big.
Oh, yeah, he had a small part in that. Yeah. He had small parts in a lot of things.
I think if people look
him up, you'll have seen him at least once. But, I would definitely go to YouTube, put in his name, and you'll laugh.
It's actually really sad because I was actually Facebook friends with him.
Yeah, me too.
And we actually talked a few times, and there was a chance at one point that he was actually going to be here on ESO and be in one of our victims in the geek seat.
Oh man, that would have been a dream come true.
We just couldn't set up schedules that matched up because he had things on Monday nights that he was doing, and this was back probably when Bobby was still with us that we were still trying to do that. And we just, we talked a few times about it, and he was always very gracious when I spoke to him, and he was just a great guy overall. And, his mantra was, I don't care. And that's how I go with the podcast. something, absolutely. Something bombs. I don't care. So it's awesome, and I was totally floored. One of my friends on Facebook, I found out from him, and he's another podcaster, and he broke the news, and it was just heartbreaking, because he wasn't that old. He was only 60, and he was just found unresponsive. He didn't have a huge drug history, or he didn't have fight depression or anything. He was one of the strongest people I knew. He was married for many years. He had a daughter, and he came out of the closet and came out that he was gay. And it took a lot to do that. And the support he had for it was just amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen so many great comedians that have responded with nothing but kindness and class during this time. So that's always that if you've got your peers' respect, that in and of itself is pretty outstanding. So
exactly, and it was just the outpouring from so many comedians: Patton Oswalt, Bobcat Goldthwait, and others. It's just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is truly a sad loss. But, again, we live in this day and age where he lives on. You get to see his routines on YouTube. I think that he's got an album, at least one on iTunes as well as some specials that I think you can buy. So I mean, he's out there, and believe me, folks, his jokes don't get old. A lot of them are kind of timeless quality. So, I definitely encourage people who are not familiar with him to seek out his work. But we also over the weekend, suffered the loss of a tremendously gifted artist, comic book artist, Steve Dillon passed away. And again, talk about things that just came out of the blue. Steve Dillon, I mean, I don't think anybody had any idea that he was, I don't know exactly what the cause of death was, but I don't think anybody had any clue that this was going to happen or this was possible. But Steve has had great runs on The Punisher, great runs on Preacher, great runs, particularly with – it works well with Garth Ennis. They worked on a lot of projects together. And, you know, he's just one of those guys that to me – I must admit I haven't read Preacher. Familiar with it, but I've never actually read it. But to me, his run – Punisher is to me like one of the best runs. There's a sequence in particular that is one of my favorite sequences between the Punisher and Daredevil, where Punisher ties him up on the rooftop and dares him pretty much to kill him, to stop him from assassinating somebody. And you can see that play out in the new Daredevil series on Netflix. That's how seminal that scene is. And they used a lot of shots. I mean, Steve kind of storyboarded it for him, you know? You know, the Welcome Back Frank storyline with Spacker Dave and all that kind of stuff. Good stuff. But very, very sad to have lost him.
Oh, very much so. He's also very well known. He got into the industry very young. His first published work was for Marvel, I think, was he was 16.
Jeez, wow.
He did a Hulk story, and it's just amazing the work he did. He did a lot of Doctor Who work for Doctor Who magazine.
Wow, I did not know that.
Some of the cartoons and such that he did, the comic strips, I should say. Then, of course, you know, he's also did a ton of Hellblazer, and the list of stuff you can name do on many, many hands. And it's just, it's such a loss. And he was only 53 years old.
I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
2016 doesn't care.
Oh, excuse me. 54. I was off.
2016 doesn't care how old you are. It'll take you down, man. This year has been awful.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, it has.
And, yeah, you know, I'm just looking at a list of his artwork, and it's just amazing. And like you said about Preacher, everything you see on the TV series, that was him creating it, him and Garth. You know, that was their work. And it's just amazing. And, you know, he did Miracle Man. He did, you know, it's really amazing when you think about all the different stuff. And some people always complain that some of his work all the faces looked very similar, but the details he got and the characterization, it was just awesome. So, you know, definitely a huge loss for the comic industry.
Wow. Absolutely. Absolutely. So our hearts go out to family, friends, obviously the fans, which we are part of. You know, like I said, their work their work lives on, because, I mean, you can go out and buy trades of this stuff, Steve's stuff. You can go out and watch stuff of videos of Kevin's work, listen to Kevin's routine. Really, really solid stuff. So I definitely encourage people, if you're not familiar with these guys, to check them out, because they were very talented individuals in their fields, and they'll be missed.
Exactly. Definitely check it out. I know Steve has a current Tumblr account. If you look at stevedillonart.tumblr.com, it has a lot of the work over the years he's done. Definitely worth checking out.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Well, okay, so I know this is awkward because, you know, we just talked about some real life deaths, but, you know, I think we have to, in this segment, also talk about some fictional characters that bit the big one this weekend. This, and this is spoiler heavy for those people who have not seen The Walking Dead premiere, season 7 premiere. You might want to just fast forward to the Geek Seek segment, because there's no way we can not talk about the events that just happened this weekend.
Okay. You've been warned. Okay. Fast forward. All right. So, Walking Dead season premiere. Negan gets his act together. And boy, does he come in swinging.
Literally.
Yeah. You had to wait through the first break to find out who bit the big one. And they pulled.
Now, let me ask you guys, was that like, okay, so we already had to wait, you know, for the whole summer, right? So we had to wait months in order to find out, because we knew that Negan took someone out, but we weren't sure who it was. And so you have to wait. Now, right away, they're not going to, you know, they're not going to tell you who did it. And so they sort of play around for the first 15, 20 minutes with letting you know at least who the first victim is. Now, I saw a lot of people complaining that, you know, they don't like getting jerked around like that. Is that, did you guys feel that way, or was it still just tension and you guys were okay with it?
Well, I kind of think that, you know, the show basically starts off with Rick just looking right at him and telling him he's going to kill him. Now, we know that any person that got their head beat in, that was going to be Rick's reaction. But I don't even know. I mean, I was so run over with a truck by the last 30 minutes of the show, or 40 minutes or whatever. I was so run over, and then the truck backed up over me a few more times. By it, that I don't even have a complaint to make about that first part. in other words, it was so devastating. I have never had that reaction to any television show in my life. Never in my life have I ever been this worked up and upset when I was watching a show. Now, that's not a negative, but I tell you what, it's so rough that there, for a lot of people out there, probably would be a negative. To me, it was just extremely intense. And so getting to, you know, who gets killed. God, I'm not even afraid. I mean, I don't even want to say it, because I don't want to be the person who gets beat up later for spoiler. I said, look, we said something about spoilers.
We did.
I got punched in the face anyway, but I didn't know that, and here it comes, kids, here comes a spoiler, you better fast forward, was that there was a double whammy to this. I did not know that. I expected for them to take out one really important person, and they did, and I was crying watching it. I mean, when they went after
Abraham, you know,
red-haired, yeah, Abraham. When he beat his head in and he didn't stop, and basically Abraham was reduced to – basically, his head was turned into a pile of slushy jello. I thought that was going to be it. I thought, my God, this is absolutely horrible. And then they went beyond that even. I mean, that was bad enough. But when he turns around after
Daryl
makes him mad and turns around and just lays into Glenn, I was in shock. I mean, I was absolutely in shock.
See, for me, I respect that. Yeah. I thought that was almost like, oh yeah, by the way, we have to kill off Glenn. Poof. I was like, they had to do that, you know?
Well, I think they tricked you. I found this out later. I have never read the comics. I mean, Mike Gordon loaned them to me, but that was a weird time in my life and I had to hand them back. So I think, but, you know, I guess if you had read the comic, you already knew that Glenn was going to get killed. And I think they almost did it as a trick, maybe.
To oh, of say, course. Cause we're gonna do they've this done, different. They've done that different times.
They've done it at different times. Time. Okay. And so, you know, I mean, it was way horrific what they did at first, but then to turn around and do that. And also to have a character that had been on the show that long. I mean, who had been there basically since day one. I was watching some footage of him from the first episode the other day. He looks like a little kid.
Yeah.
And to have him, you know, turn around and right in front of his pregnant wife, have his brains beat in with one eye popped halfway out, and the guy making fun of him while we're doing it. I mean, we've got a lot of emotional time invested in Glenn, You know, this is emotional investment in characters. And to have him humiliated as well as killed, like by a guy who does not know him, and we do, made it even more horrifying. It was probably the single most grueling 5 minutes for me in television history. I'm trying to think of something that was worse, but I can't think of what there was. Like, I
yeah, it's worthy of note because you know, I've seen a lot of people. I mean, obviously, you know, whether it was Joss Whedon killing characters on us, or George R. R. Martin, and certainly, you know, The Red Wedding is a pinnacle of gruesomeness that happens for fictional characters.
Right.
But yeah, there's, you know, and this show is about zombies. It's not like we're not used to characters getting killed.
Right.
But even in and Mike's read the comics, so we both are familiar with the comics. So we both have known that, you know, as far as the storyline goes, Abraham and Glenn both are kind of marked for goners.
Right.
Now, whether or not the series is going to do that, because as Mike alluded to, sometimes they kill him, sometimes the show has its own, you know, muse, so to speak. It does what it will.
Yeah.
But what I really appreciate, and you know, I was sad to lose those characters, but you know, in one medium, I've already lost them. So it's not like it was that, you know, I don't think I was coming at it from that perspective.
Yeah.
But what I really appreciated about the show, the episode, was that to me, it was all about Negan and breaking Rick. And you really had to be sold on that, because when Rick is like, I am going to kill you, like, and he says that right in the beginning, and, you know, Negan has to break him. And he does, and you can't, I don't think after the hour is done, you can argue that, oh, I don't really buy that Rick's broken. No, I mean, we're all pretty broken up after the end of this hour. And I was pretty sure, I was 99% sure that he wasn't going to make Rick actually take out Carl's arm.
Yeah.
But I still had them back in my head. But then again, see, I know some events that happen later on.
Yeah.
And I know that Carl's kind of integral to that. So I'm thinking, yeah, they're probably not really going to do that. So some knowledge of the comic actually helps me through this.
It buffered you, actually. Yeah, exactly. I would say it buffered you, because for me, I mean, take it. I don't. You can't. So then you can't even imagine what I felt when I was watching it, because I was.
Well, I can,
blank,
because I read it.
Well, no. But what I'm saying, as a blank slate, this, I mean, I never got to read the comic, almost like reading a storyboard of what's going to potentially happen. I mean, I'm literally seeing this, getting my first bits for the first time. I didn't pay any attention to anything last night or the night before on the TV. And I got up this morning and I streamed it, and I was in shock because I did not know any of this was going to happen. I knew somebody was going to get their head beat in, but I just didn't know who it was. And when they did it, and then they did more of it, by the time it was over, I was just like, well, that's probably the single most, in a positive way, the single most traumatic thing I've ever seen a TV series do.
Well, it was pretty amazing, because the scene when Rick was laying on top of the camper and he was picturing everyone getting their heads bashed in.
Yeah.
It was just wow. And that was powerful. But I also thought when Negan and Rick were sitting at the table in the camper and Negan had the axe in his hand,
I said, you thought he's going to take his hand.
Yeah, exactly. Because in the comic, Rick only has one hand because it was taken from by the governor.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, they're finally going to do that. But no.
Interesting.
They went a different way. So there's a lot of things that they kind of, you know, go twist and turn with as far as those of us there. I think they're really smart, because I think, you know, the writing doesn't get a lot of credit. I think there's a lot of people who have given up on the show, and because it's so popular, they, you know, there's a lot of critics out there on it. And look, I'm not saying that the show is beyond criticism, because is it perfect? No. But I do think, you know, that they when they get it right.
Yeah.
Man, because they have to appease or appeal to the audience that's never read the comic, and they have to keep those of us who've read the comic kind of guessing and interested as well. And last night was a perfect example of them doing both and honoring the comic, honoring the decisions made in the comic about which characters needed to go and why, and yeah. yet showing us it's a game changer. I mean, this show is different from here on in. I mean, I think as far as season openers goes for The Walking Dead, I don't think I've been this excited to see what happens next since the original series premiere.
Yeah. Well, I do know that there's a lot of backlash and negative talk, you know, today with people saying they're not going to watch it anymore. And there was other people that said they never watch it. All I know is that for me, there's been a couple of shows in the last 3 or 4 years that I absolutely cannot miss. And that doesn't mean that I don't watch them when they air. But as soon as that box set's available or as soon as something's ready to stream on Netflix – or if you've got a friend who loans it, you know what I'm saying? You're just ready to gobble it up like, you know, it's like eating a whole cake and you don't get fat. And I think that you know, we were talking the other day about Penny Dreadful was one of them. And this is one of the ones that I have to watch. And I never find it boring. I mean, I've heard people say it's up, it's down, this isn't so good. I've never found it boring. I watch it and I'm like, I love this show. I just think it's a great show. It's really hard, though. And I think that Greg Nicotero, because of all the work that he does with Quentin Tarantino, I think that's rubbed off on him a bit in that in those moments in Tarantino, like the torture scene in Reservoir Dogs with the police officer in the ear. I think that he's picking up a bit of that. How can I just make it so intense you can barely – you're just going to scream, you know? So –
that's a good way to put it, though, because yeah. it's just like, oh, my God, because this episode did not let you catch your breath.
No, no, it was as relentless as what was going on in the story. It was you totally riveted, mm-hmm. you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what was great about it. And I am so, you know, I wasn't sad to see Abraham go. And I figured Glenn somehow would have to go because – that's what
Maggie needs to grow.
And this,
like Maggie can't become the character that we know she can become until she loses.
Because let you in a little secret about what's to come, at least through the comic, guys.
Okay.
Is Maggie becomes a kick-ass character.
Right.
She becomes one of the strongest characters because of what happens to Glenn.
Sure, sure. I mean, I could see that going that direction. Well, to me, Glenn was always the best of the group in terms of his morals, and he tried to maintain them. And he always tried to be a good guy, and he's been on the show so long that he's part of our – for me, he was part of the emotional glue and the emotional DNA of that show. To see him get his head caved in last night was really rough.
Yeah, and there is no coming back from this one.
No, there is no – you couldn't even come back as a zombie. His head's gone basically. Yeah. But that whole part where he's sitting there trying to mumble that he'll find her, man, that made it even worse. And, you know, of course, somebody today put the mutated guy from
– I saw that.
The Goonies. Goonies. Yeah. And then Glenn say, I'll find you or something like that. It's like, man, some people are cold, just cold. But, yeah, that was a heart-wrenching scene with him trying to say it, you know.
And, oh, exactly. And Negan going, oh, look, he's trying to say something.
Oh, and can we, on that note, can we just say how cool Jeremy, Jeremy Dean, what is the actor's name?
Dean, now you got.
Morgan, Jeremy Dean Morgan, right?
Jeremy Dean Morgan, yeah.
Jeffrey Dean Morgan, how amazing he is. You know, when he was cast, I was kind of like, okay, I can kind of see it, but man, I think... You know, I was terrified of when I read Walking Dead issue 100 and the incident that we're seeing here, although it's on a much smaller scale than what we see in the show. But Glenn buys it in issue 100, and that's a really hard. I mean, that's a you know a comic. If that's gonna if a comic can make you cry, man, that one comes so close. Like wow. It's a pretty devastating moment in the comic, and I was like, how are they going to bring this to life? Because it's just brutal. Not only did they do that, but I found Negan more menacing in the show than I did in the comic. He's got a little bit of charm on him. You really see that in his mind. He's not the bad guy. And he almost is able to convince you, even though these characters are at his mercy. He could be so much more brutal if he wanted to be.
The guy's always been a good actor. I remember seeing him on Grey's Anatomy, and then of course in The Watchmen and Supernatural and all that kind of stuff. And
he's really fun in The Losers.
Yeah, he is really comfortable in front of the camera. That's one of the great things that all actors are. When they're comfortable in front of the camera, and he is comfortable. And, I don't know what you guys know, because I've heard three or four people say, well, there's a part of him that you got to realize he isn't a bad guy. I see a complete bastard. I don't know what you guys are saying. Maybe I don't know what's coming around the corner, but this guy. But the thing is that he's doing it with a smile. That's probably one of the reasons he's got all those followers, is that he is comfortable in his own skin. Even with this gang of thugs, they feel like they will always be safe. But the guy's smiling through all this crap, all this zombie apocalypse. It's like, that's the guy we got to follow. I mean, that's the only thing I can think. But
well, he's got an element of charm to him, and Jeffrey brings that out, of course. But
sure.
You know, I mean, this is a group that's attacked his people and has killed multiple of his people, and his reaction is one that, if it were up to his men, though, like Rick's crew would already be dead 10 times over. He saves them for whatever reason, because he wants to use them to his own ends, and he manages to break Rick, which is something that nobody's been able to do all during the whole run of this show.
Right.
Not even the governor can say that.
No, I mean, it's unusual. It's a strange thing about this show, is that they seem to almost begin to start to repeat themselves, and then there's just that turn that makes it all feel different. Like the governor still feels different. Terminus still feels different. And this feels different. Although you're kind of like, okay, we're starting the same plot line again, a big place with walls that they slide the wall back and you go inside the town.
Yeah,
but it's never the same thing.
The difference is the characters are different now, because the people that we've been following for 7 seasons are now broken.
Yeah.
In a way that we've never seen them broken before.
Yeah, it was 40 miles of bad road. I'll tell you that, man. Last night was rough.
Oof. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, yeah.
And it's going to be interesting to see where they go with it from here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and that's going to be part of the fun. I'm actually looking forward to seeing, you know, how, if they're going to stick towards close to the comic, and or if they're going to spread it out over a couple seasons before they go to war, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah,
because
I don't know. It's going to be a fun ride.
Oh yeah, and the chemistry between Negan and Rick is awesome. In a good way, you know.
Yes. Yes.
So, and they just play. They play off each other really well.
This show just got. I mean, as Mark said, I never didn't feel like anything was wrong with the show beforehand. In fact, I kind of liked last season.
Oh, I loved it. Yeah.
But this show just got injected with a huge amount of adrenaline.
Yeah.
And I think it's just going to be a fun ride for the next 14, 15 episodes.
Well, I mean, the thing is for me, too, is that I thought last year was completely amazing. I mean, my mouth was hanging open through many episodes, especially when they got those big episodes, you know, the mid-season, cliffhanger and all that. I mean, it's just amazing what they were doing. And it's like, how do you ratchet this up? Well, I'll say this. This is the darkest moment in the show's history to me, what I saw last night. And I think that they've ratcheted it up to an R-rated or an NC-17 rated level.
Yeah, yeah.
Apparently, I don't know whether this is true or not, but the Parents Television Council said The Walking Dead crossed the line. It's like, well, what parents are letting their kids watch this thing in the first place? Go upstairs, turn off the lights, and go to bed.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is not a show. It's never been a show for children, but I mean, this one especially. There's warnings all over the place. Any person letting their kids watch this ought to be ashamed of themselves.
Well, okay.
No, I'm serious. No, I mean, that is hard R-rated crap that happened.
No, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right.
At that.
Yeah, and it has been for a while. I mean, this is not the first time they've danced around this. So
sure, sure.
I mean, it's it's been pretty brutal from day one. But
yeah,
oh. Exactly. And you know, things like going back from when Lori was eaten after she delivered the baby.
Oh yeah.
Or to, you know, a lot of the different things you had over the seasons.
What happened to the girls, man? That still haunts me.
Oh yes.
Which because story? That stuff
oh,
wasn't
oh,
even,
the two little girls.
The two little yeah, girls.
That stuff wasn't even man. That stuff wasn't even in the comic. That just was wrong.
It was wrong and brilliant at the same yes. time.
Not to quote something from earlier in this episode, but that's not right.
Exactly. I mean, that was so disturbing.
Yeah, that was rough, man. I mean, some of the stuff on this stuff is amazing. There's been once or twice where I almost, like, there was one episode where the baby in the basket, it was, like, on the ground and a zombie was crawling towards it. And I stood up and started to walk out of the room. I'm like, I can't watch that. Luckily, the baby didn't get eaten. But, man, just the image of a baby there with a zombie coming after it is just bad. I don't even know how to say it.
Mm-hmm. No, you said it perfectly, actually. And they just had so many different moments, and it's just like,
And there's still some to come.
Oh, yeah.
Believe you me. I mean, Mike and I are privy to some information that they may or may not do, but the storylines that go from here, fasten your seatbelt, because it's going to get – it's bumpy.
Yeah, Herschel's death bothered me a lot.
Oh, that was so rough. Right. What a shocker. When he started chopping into his neck, and I'm like, oh, I can't believe this is happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it used to be back in the 70s when they showed some, or the 80s, it would have been a dream sequence, you know? Oh, and the person wakes up. Not anymore. We're not in television land like that anymore.
No.
You know, man, whew, people are expendable.
Oh, no one is safe on Walking Dead. So,
man.
But the best meme I saw afterwards, it's like, oh my God, we lost two of our own on Walking Dead. And then underneath they had Game of Thrones and they said, bitch, please.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, I really did think they were going to take, I like you, I wasn't sure where they're going to take Carl's arm, but they got so close. I thought they're actually going to do it. And they pulled away. The intensity was there enough. Mm-hmm. To where when they didn't, it was like I was already so devastated by everything that had happened. By the time they got to that point and they pulled away and you found out it wasn't, it's like, okay, leave me like one moment. Leave me one little piece of my brain intact today, okay?
I got to give credit to Chandler too, because that's a pretty intense scene. And he, you know, in a lot of ways, Carl saved the day there, man. I mean, if Carl doesn't tell his dad, go ahead, do it, you know, who knows what happens?
Yeah. I've heard people bitch about that character before. I like the kid. I think he's good.
I do too.
I like
too.
Him.
There's been some episodes with him that I think have been outstanding.
Yeah, I think so too.
Mm-hmm.
So cool.
So were you guys surprised at home or not? And also, Mr. Mike, you have one other thing you want to talk about.
Well, just real quick, because I know that we've, you know, rant and raved a lot.
Never.
I know, right? I finally got a chance to see Evil Dead the Musical because it was playing here in Atlanta for the first time. My company finally decided to make it happen. It was called Out of Box Theater, and they're in Marietta. And a small little company of actors, but they did a great job. It's a fun show that pulls elements from all of the Evil Dead movies, even a little bit of Army of Darkness, really. And of course, it's done tongue in cheek. There's a splatter zone in the front row, which I did not sit in because, man, they really got it. Actually, our good friend Mike from Titan Comics, he was at the performance and he did sit in the splatter zone. And you guys should look check out his account on Instagram because he got doused. He and his party that he was with, they got blood all over them. You know, it was a fun show, and I'm glad I saw it. You know, it's a musical. It's kind of campy. It's done like in the style of Rocky Horror or Little Shop of Horrors, that kind of thing. Maybe it's not up to that quality, but it's still got that tone to it. And they're like, you know, as far as, well, it should go without saying, but it's, you know, it's not something you want to bring the kids to, obviously, not because of the gore or anything, just because of the language and adult situations and that kind of thing. But it is based on an R-rated movie, so you might want to, use your judgment against on that. But I if you get a chance to see it, anybody out there, because I know local places do perform it, I definitely recommend it because it was a good show.
Awesome. Cool. Definitely would like to check it out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because Ash versus the Walking Dead is coming back.
I'm it's into the second season. I watched the fourth episode last night, and I think the second season is even better than the first season. It's really fun.
Well, of course it is. Lee Majors.
Lee Majors is in it, playing Ash's dad, and man, that's just one of the many cool things about it. But it's a fun show.
I love it. I saw the first season and I absolutely love it. So. Yeah.
The second season, right away, it'll get you, and it picks up right up there and just goes. It's so fun.
Cool.
Awesomeness. Anything you guys want to talk about at home, write us, esopodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you guys. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment with The Geek Seat.
Thank you very much. Thank you. My name is Kevin Meaney. Thinking about changing my first name to Eenie. Thank you. Eenie Meenie, figure it out for yourselves, folks. Parents' names are Meenie and Moe. I have a little brother by the name of Teeny Meenie. And I have an Aunt Jeannie. Good night, everybody. Thank you. I'm so glad I have you right here. Thank God, my eye! I'm going to poke my eye out. I don't believe it. My mother would say, you're doing that on purpose. Putting the microphone in your eye. Why do you do things like that? You're like a crazy person. The other comedians aren't poking their eyes out. Why do you have to do that? One of these days, one of your crazy friends is going to put a needle in that microphone. And it's going to be real funny, isn't it? Walking around with one eye. Why do you do this to your father and I? You're like a mental case on stage. I don't think you want to see. You probably have your one-eye jokes already written. God, you're like a crazy person. Anything in my house could poke an eye out when I was a kid. Be passing pizza across the table. You're going to take your brother's eye out with that slice. Now put your goggles on and go to bed. And stop rolling around up there. Rolling in the bed. Why are you rolling? Your brothers don't roll. Your father doesn't roll. You're like a crazy person rolling. Rolling, rolling, rolling. You're gonna fall out of that bed and poke your eye out. They were crazy, not me. We couldn't wear tight pants growing up in my family. We couldn't wear tight pants. You're not wearing those tight pants out, mister. Put your big pants on. Going outside with tight pants on. We're big pant people. Get upstairs your room and put your big pants on. The Lobermans are coming over. And you're wearing tight pants. Why? Your father doesn't wear tight pants. Well, it's good to be here. I went shopping today. I go shopping. People mistake me for an employee. Ladies come up to me. Pardon me, sir. Where do I return the gifts? I'll give them to me. Take anything you like and walk right out that door with it. Are you sure? I never heard of that policy before. Oh, ladies are stuck at the door. He said I could take it. I'm not a shoplifter. He's a crazy person. I was driving today. I drive around. You ever notice, like, things on the side of the road? See a shoe just lying there? Figure maybe some guy on his way to work. You know, I'm not wearing my left shoe today. Gonna toss that baby right out the window. See what the boss says about that. You'll even see that downtown. See a pair of pants on the sidewalk. A tight pair of pants. I told you take those things off. People in camouflage clothes. You ever see them? No, you can't see them. They're camouflage. They're walking around. Nobody sees me. I'm camouflage. So this guy had camouflage pants on. I said, hey, where are your legs? They're camouflage, you jerk. The other day we saw a car painted with camouflage paint. Just to prove a point, we ran into it. Camouflage sure didn't fit. I don't drive that much. I have a jetpack. Pop in on Housewives to see if they're wrapping things fresh. crazy clapping. Why are you clapping? He'll just continue.
I drove cross country, really got to see the country. Notice that there's no dotted lines between the states. Also, Kansas is not pink. These are map jokes. Please try to follow me, all right? Great jokes to tell in the car. I don't use a map. They're too big. You open them up, they're as big as the car. You should be like me when you drive. Use a globe. Have that baby right next to you while you're traveling. Well, I'm in North America. Can you tell me what latitude I'm in? Tough time getting that thing back in the glove compartment, you know? Get it back in. No place for your gloves. I don't care, I don't care. My jokes don't go over, I don't care. Everybody, I don't care, I don't... He does not care! I don't care, I don't care, I don't... He does not care! I don't care. I'm happy-go-lucky, women call me plucky. I don't care, I don't care. Shut up, I don't care. Look out, Hank Mancini. Here comes Zini Meany. I don't care. One more time. No! I don't care. We hate you. I don't care. Zoom, zoom, zoom. Bing, bing, bing. This is stupid. Making noises on the Johnny Carson show. You're like a crazy person. Why do you do this to your father and I? Thank you very much.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back. Now we are here for the Geek Seat segment with author John Hartness. Welcome, John.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Great. Welcome to the station. Finally, we get you on here. So it's been too long, sir. And for those people who may not know who you are, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm John Hartness. I write things. I'm also the founder and publisher of Falstaff Books, which is a micro press based out of Charlotte. We focus on genre fiction, so science fiction, fantasy, and horror. You can go to falstaffbooks.com to find out more about us. As a writer, I am the author of the Black Knight Chronicles urban fantasy series. I also write the Bubba the Monster Hunter series of novellas and short stories, and I write the Quincy Harker Demon Hunter dark fantasy series. I also do a newish podcast called Writing Rants, where I swear profusely about the publishing industry.
That could take a long time.
I think I got plenty to mine for future episodes.
Absolutely.
And then I also am on the Authors and Dragons podcast, where six science fiction and fantasy comedy writers get together and play Pathfinder over Skype every 2 weeks and record our ineptitude over Skype for the masses.
Very cool. Very cool.
We may be the worst adventuring party in the history of gaming.
Find out. Listen up. I want to talk to you a little bit about particularly your horror writing. Sure. It's fair to say that is definitely at the forefront of most of your writing work, correct?
You know, it's funny, probably, but the lines between urban fantasy and dark fantasy and horror are so blurred. I got into this thinking I was an urban fantasy writer. You know, I make the joke on panels at conventions that I rip off Jim Butcher for a living. And, you know, obvious, I guess it's okay, because when I was on a panel with Butcher and used that line, he followed up with, well, I'm Jim Butcher and I rip off Joss Whedon for a living.
See, right.
So, you know, we're all stealing from somebody. He just steals from somebody a little better than I do.
Well, I was gonna ask you about some of your influences, but right there, I mean, I guess that covers.
Butcher and Whedon cover a lot of it. But, you know, I didn't think I was writing horror until Black Knight 4, Paint It Black, was nominated for a horror award. It won the EPIC, the Electronic Publishing Industry Coalition, Best Horror Novel. And I was like, oh, well, I guess I'm a horror writer. Because I don't know what the line is, you know, those terms are, they're publishing industry terms and they're bookstore terms.
Right.
And there's not even a horror shelf in bookstores in America anymore. So
Well, I mean, obviously, not only Buffy, but in particular, as far as the literary world is concerned, you know, there was Harry Potter, but then Twilight just sort of changed everything, right?
It did. It was those are real game changers. Anything that can surpass the page and move into that cultural consciousness. Buffy did it. I mean, it started as a film and then a TV show and then moved into graphic novels and tie-in novels, but it transcended genre, and Twilight transcended genre as well. A lot of people rag on those books, and I'm not a huge fan of the series, but I'm a huge fan of what they accomplished.
Absolutely. To see lines, people lining up to get something in a bookstore that's a book, that's pretty exciting.
I know, right? And we needed that when those books came out, because we'd had that with Harry Potter, but Harry Potter was over. And there's this whole group of people that came into Harry Potter late in the series or late-ish, book 4 or 5, and they were, you know, middle school when those books came out. So they're out of high school when Harry Potter is done. And if we don't keep those people reading and interested in books, we lose them forever, because people get busy. And that's a time in your life when you're going to college or learning what your job is and getting into serious relationships and moving away from home, and the world gets busy. So the fact that Twilight was able to then jump right on the back of Harry Potter and capture those people, it made them lifetime readers.
Absolutely.
And I really appreciate that. And I've gotten into arguments, because I'm an argumentative kind of guy, but I've gotten into arguments with other writers who are slagging on Twilight. And I'm like, look, all that does is make you look like a jerk. It makes you look like a jerk. It makes you look like you're punching down intellectually, and you're hurting the feelings of Twilight fans. And
which it could be an absolute gateway to other people's work.
It 100% is. Yeah, maybe the books weren't great, but if people get in the habit of reading about vampires, I'm getting paid.
Exactly.
Because Stephanie Meyer only wrote 4 books in that series. Or 3, 4? I don't know. She didn't write very many, and she's done. So, and the books have been done for, what, like 8 or 9 years or more?
Wow, has it been that long? Yeah.
It's been a while, and we're still talking about it. So, you know, she ain't winning no Man Booker Prize, but neither is anybody on this podcast, yo.
Absolutely. Well, obviously, your sort of inspiration from Buffy in a lot of ways can be translated to your, you know, Bubba the Monster Hunter character, right?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
100%. I tell people that Bubba is what you get if Larry the Cable Guy and Buffy had a baby.
Nice.
And he played defensive end for the Georgia Bulldogs.
That series has been going on for quite some time.
I tried to count. The last one I released was Midsummer, and I say it's Bubba season 3, episode 3. Yeah, it's been going since probably 2011. And because I wrote primarily short stories, I think if we include the Great Grandpappy Beauregard stories, I think I'm at 30 stories and novellas in that world.
That's amazing.
So something like 350,000 words in about some redneck ex-football player who shoots monsters and gets confused when they tell him to chase a chupacabra, and he ends up thinking he's chasing a chalupa.
It's great. I've read quite a few of the stories, and they are very entertaining.
There's no joke too cheap. Nope. There is no line too low. It's 100% populist humor. I love writing those stories. I'm working on the 4th story in season 3 right now, and it's Oh, Bubba, Where Art Thou?
Nice. It's so much fun, and you could tell reading it that you have fun writing it.
I'm playing with so many things, and some of them get actually deeply personal. This story is very personal to me because it's all about music, and music's been such a huge part of my life, my whole life. And my sister is a featured character in it. Couple of my nieces are going to be featured in it. I get to put them in my stories and play around and then, you know, make magic happen and do ghost things and stuff. It's great. It's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And like I said, it comes across on the page. I definitely encourage those people to check that out. I can see that the chair, the geek seat is hungry, but before we strap you down in there, what's the latest project that you want to promote?
All right, I've got two. Heaven's Door, which is the latest Quincy Harker Demon Hunter novella, just released last week. And if people thought that the Harker series was dark before, they ain't seen nothing yet. I'm not quite in Cormac McCarthy territory, but stuff gets real, y'all.
And for those people who don't know, this is a continuation, obviously, from the Dracula, the original Dracula novel. Is it Quincy's son?
Jonathan Harker and Mina Murray had in lore in the canon. Jonathan Harker and Mina Murray had a son, and he was named Quincy, and he had four first names after each of the four male characters in Dracula. So I decided, you know, I basically said, I want to write Constantine, but I want to write it old school Hellblazer Garth Ennis style. Because I was such a huge fan of the Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon, God rest him.
Absolutely.
Broke me. Yeah. I mean, I was really upset about that. But I was such a huge fan of that series back in the 90s. And then I heard it was going to TV and I was like, well, you can't drop the F-bomb on NBC. So it's not going to work. Fortunately, I was wrong. I thought the series kind of worked. It was pretty good. Quincy Harker is me using these characters from Dracula canon to tell a dark fantasy story in the Garth Ennis Hellblazer style.
Excellent. Excellent. And so, what's the second project?
The second project is coming out next week digitally and hopefully before the election in print. And it's called We Are Not This, Carolina Writers for Equality. And it is a charity anthology for LGBTQ charities in North Carolina. And it is all writers with deep ties to North Carolina writing, basically giving stories in protest of HB2, House Bill 2, which was restricting protections for LGBTQ citizens in North Carolina. I have a lot of friends in that community, and I felt that it was important for me and for Falstaff Books to take a stand, and we are putting out an anthology with people like A.J. Hartley, who's a New York Times bestseller, David Childers, who's one of the best songwriters I've ever worked with. Tamsin Silver has a story in the book, Faith Knaff. We've just got some Natanya Barron, Jay Reckward. We've got some amazing authors who have contributed stories to this charity anthology, and it'll be coming out in digital format next week. And all proceeds are divided amongst three North Carolina-based LGBTQ charities. So,
excellent.
Yeah.
Where can people find out more about that?
They can go to falstaffbooks.com and find out more about that, or they can look for me on Facebook and send me hate mail. Or whatever.
No. Well, I'm sure you get some anyway. But, yes. Well, like I said, the seat is hungry. So without further ado, Mike, he is as strapped in as I can get him.
Well, we had to use, enforcement tonight to strap him down and everything. we've heard the stories about you, John, so it's okay.
Unfortunately, they're all true.
Of course they are.
Every one of them.
All right, Mr. Mike, Let's make sure straps are done. All right, John. First question in the geek seat. What was your favorite geek out moment?
All right. Well, I've been a geek for a long time, and I've had a lot of them. The first time I met Neil Gaiman was a pretty big one. This was back before he was Neil effing Gaiman. This was back when he was just that dude who wrote Sandman comics.
Oh, sure.
And there was still a three-hour line at Dragon Con in 1992 to meet him. But really, when I got on a Dragon Con panel and I was sitting next to Jim Butcher, that was it.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah, being able to sit next to one of the people who really got me into reading and writing in this genre was amazing.
Oh, sure. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm honored that, you know, Jim knows who I am now, and we chat a little when we're at conventions together. But the first time I sat on a panel with him, I was squeeing inside the whole time.
What was your most disappointing geek out moment?
You know, you got to love teachable moments, right? My most disappointing geek out moment, I'm not going to name names because that'll come back to bite you. But I was at a convention back in the 90s, probably. It might have been that Dragon Con, but I don't remember. There was a comic book writer that I was a big fan of, not Neil Gaiman, but a different comic book writer. And he had just published his first fantasy novel. And I had comics that I wanted him to sign. And I wanted to talk about his writing in the comics because, well, I hadn't read the novel yet. But I'd read his comics for years. And he blew me off. He was just kind of abrupt and kind of cold. And I get it. He was tired of talking about comics. He was there being a novelist. But what I learned from that is you can't have an off moment when you're in public. You don't get that. When you publish something and people pay you money for it, and then you do appearances where you know you're interacting with people, you don't get to be off your game. You're on. And I've used this example ever since I've gotten into publishing. I tell everybody I work with, everybody I publish, if you're at a convention, from the second you walk out of your hotel room in the morning to the second you are back in your hotel room alone or with your roommate at the end of the night, you're on. You got to behave like somebody's watching you, because the minute you're a jerk to somebody, 20 years later, they're on a podcast telling somebody about it. And they're going to name names. So,
oh, yeah. What geeks you out the most?
Magic the Gathering.
What about it?
I'm just a huge Magic nerd. I actually, most Monday nights, I would be playing Magic. You guys are saving me money by doing this interview, because I'd be out spending money playing Magic tonight. I love the game. I played it in college. I got back into it. It's all Brandon Sanderson's fault. He got me back into playing when I was at a convention a few years ago. I play the game probably 3 or 4 times a week. Love it.
Gotcha.
The complexity of it, the interaction. Mm-hmm.
Let's look at the flip side then. What turns your geek off?
Okay, here's where the hate mail comes. Doctor Who. It just bores me. It's not my thing at all.
Wow. Okay. What is your email address?
That is mike.gordon@yahoo.com.
Well, I thought that was howdy Mike Gordon at. What fictional character would you like to meet the most?
Silk, Prince Keldar from the Belgariad, a series by David Eddings from the 80s and 90s. I hope, I have hear rumors that it's coming out in ebook in 2017. But this guy is a rogue and a gambler and an actor and a fighter and a lover and a crap talker. Like my boy Enzo Amore from the WWE. He's a smack talker Skywalker, and he's got a microphone Mike Sabre for a hater.
And you can't teach that.
How you doing?
What fictional character would you like to meet the least?
Oh, man. If any of you guys have ever read I Am Not a Serial Killer, I'm pretty sure it's Dan Wells.
Wow. Okay.
Yes, it's Dan Wells. I Am Not a Serial Killer. The protagonist of those books is scary as crap. He is just this creepy teenage kid who's got all of these routines built in to keep himself from going over the edge and becoming a complete psychopath. It's also a little afraid of Zachary Quinto.
I can understand that. I can see that. Yeah, I can.
He was, his Skyler was really, really good and scary.
Almost too good.
He played it too naturally.
Ah, that was too easy, bro. Yeah. But if you but if you've got an Audible account, and if you don't, there's probably a way you can sign up for a 30-day free trial using a code for this podcast. But anyway, if you have an Audible account for like a couple more days, Zachary Quinto narrated a John Scalzi novella called The Dispatcher, and it's free on Audible. Oh my God, it might be the best thing Scalzi's ever written.
Awesome.
I loved that story. And Zachary Quinto does such phenomenal narration. He's a breathtaking actor, and I would never, ever want to meet him at a dark alley.
What is your favorite geek word, phrase, quote, or pose?
Probably, well, I mean, Smack Talk of Skywalker with a mic saber for a hate is pretty good. Anything that Ric Flair has ever said. But if we're gonna get real geek, it's probably So Say We All.
Oh, sure.
Or You Can't Take the Sky From Me.
Love both of those.
Yeah, it's probably those.
What is your ideal geek occupation?
I'm pretty sure I have it. I mean, I write vampire books for a living. I don't think it gets any better than that.
It doesn't suck.
No, it's great. And
but you haven't heard that one before.
Right. Once or twice.
What is your geek occupation that you would not like to do?
Animation.
Really?
I have zero talent in it. Everything would turn out looking like a stick figure with a potato for a head. So I'm awful at it, so I've just never developed any real interest in wanting to do it. Yeah, I can't draw a straight line with two rulers.
Are you ready for your final question, John?
Bring it.
All right. What is your ultimate geek fantasy?
You know, a Golden Globe for one of my books being turned into a movie or TV show would be pretty high up there. But, since that's more pipe dream than fantasy, to be able to get Vin Diesel to actually come play one of our live Authors and Dragons Pathfinder sessions and record that for the podcast, because he is a big gamer. He loves D&D, and we have a running gag on the podcast that Vin Diesel is always present in on our podcasts, but he's contractually not allowed to ever speak.
Well, there you go.
To get Vin Diesel to be able to speak on one of our Authors and Dragons podcasts, that would be my ultimate geek fantasy.
Even if all he says is, I am Groot.
That's fine.
I could see that. Well, John, guess what? You've made it through the geek seat. Congratulations. Woo-hoo. Mr. Mike Gordon, tell the young man what he's won.
You have won a lifetime subscription to the ESO Network, a value easily worth $68.04.
4 whole cents. Awesome. Sweet. It's like gone up in value.
A little bit. Yeah, it's kind of shaky, though. So by the time you get off the station, it probably is not going to be worth that.
Oh, well. All right.
Very cool. Well, it was very cool to finally get you down, strap you down in the chair. For those people who want to check out your books and everything else you got going on, your blog, as well as your podcast, where can people find you?
I am John Hartness pretty much everywhere. It's johnhartness.com. You can find me on Twitter at John Hartness. Facebook.com/John G Hartness is my author page. Falstaffbooks.com, at Falstaff Books. Those things. I apparently have an Instagram account. Don't expect much out of that. Because I, I'm not sure I know what Instagram is, but I have an account.
Yeah, welcome to the social media world, right?
I know, right? I think I have a Google Plus account. Is that still the thing?
I don't know. In any case, we will have links to all of this in our show notes so that people can click and find you. So Yay. Thanks again for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I'll be back anytime you guys want me.
Awesome.
Wow, we might actually have to take you up on that one, sir.
Anytime.
Let's take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment.
Howdy and welcome back. It's our final episode of our countdown to Halloween, and with us we are going to talk all about the men who make the monsters come to life, monster men, various actors and actresses who have brought the creatures to life that haunt our dreams. And with us, of course, Mark is still with us as he has been all month, and we have joining us Ryan Cadaver from the Casket Creatures.
How's it going?
Howdy, right. Sir. Yeah, welcome. It's been too long, sir.
I know. I'm glad to be back, man. Like, the last couple times are so much fun. So, actually, it popped up recently on my newsfeed that me and Derek were hanging. Derek from the Gas Creatures, he's our guitarist, and we were hanging out and getting drunk and preparing to get ready for a podcast about the Wolfman. And that was probably one of the best days ever. I was like, we're sitting around watching Universal horror movies. It's almost Halloween, and we're about to do a podcast. It's going to be awesome. So it's it's always good times.
Yes, and I'm just glad that in this, you know, this month we were able to get you in, because I know that touring this month is crazy for you guys.
Yeah, it's been very busy. Not as busy as last year's, but it's been pretty intense.
Well, I can definitely tell everybody out there that if they get a chance to see you, man, because I just saw you Saturday and you rocked the Sweetwater Bar and Grill, man.
Thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate you coming out. That was a really fun show.
Absolutely, it was. So definitely. And, you know, we'll find out when we do the shout outs where people can reach you and all that. But right now, we're going to talk all about the monster men, as we call them. And as we have with all of the other subjects this month, we're going to start with the silent era, because, boy, that's where really I think the name, I don't know if the name itself, the moniker monster men, came from. But boy, when I look back at some of those performances by some of those actors, they didn't have the courtesy of having sound effects or being able to speak. So they really had to sell you on what creature they were bringing to life. And some of them still to this day, I find absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. You started back, it's the silent era, and it's also in a lot of ways the German silent era, you know, pre Hitler's Germany. There was a lot of super creativity going on in Germany at the time. There was expressionism and all that, and there were actors coming out of it, like Conrad Veidt, who was really famous for playing the sleepwalking killer in Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Very, very creepy, neat, a horror film with this psychopath running around through all these distorted sets. And he was also, this actor was also the man who laughs, which any person who listens to your podcast has probably seen pictures of him, because he is given a lot of credit for the for being where the inspiration for the Joker from Batman
Absolutely.
Came from.
Absolutely.
And he was a terrific actor. He would later be considered for some of the Universal roles that he didn't get, him like Dracula and things like that. And I think that would have been kind of neat to have seen him do it in another reality. But it is probably one of his most famous roles after being a horror man was being a Nazi and getting shot by Humphrey Bogart at the end of Casablanca.
Yep.
And he's a great actor. He was a really, really good actor. But those Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, The Man Who Laughs, I've seen them both many times. They're great to watch, and he's terrific in them. And then we move on to like Max Schreck. He's one of those people that has actually transcended time in terms of like people from nowadays, whether you're a punk rocker or an old man or a little kid, everybody loves Max Schreck as Nosferatu. People still love looking at that film. And, you know, like I said before, I remember my dad and my brothers and sisters watching The Exorcist on HBO, and we were all kind of nervous because we had never seen it before. But then, like, the next week on PBS, they showed Nosferatu, and we were caught off guard. It was like, this is an old silent film. And when he comes out, you know, with that big rat-like fingers and all that kind of stuff and that long, nasty face, I remember looking back at my dad. He had a pillow in front of his head. He was so scared. But and then briefly, you know, Paul Wegener, who played the Golem, he was a big German actor at the time. And one of the last ones is Emil Jannings. He was played Faust and stuff in these really neat movies. You have to see them to believe them. They're some of the most creative films I'd ever seen. But if you watch the movie The Inglourious Basterds, he's one of the Nazis that gets killed by the guys when they blow up the movie theater at the end. And then, you know, but the Germans did a lot of great stuff for this and, towards these kind of films. And then we move into, you know, what the United States was doing with basically their biggest movie star and about the biggest movie star in that era. And that's Lon Chaney Sr. Lon Chaney Sr., I believe at the time, even over any other actor, was the biggest name draw, especially in the 20s, over any other actor in Hollywood. And he did a lot of great bizarre makeups. We talked about some of them last week. But he had some that he was really, really famous for, most notably the ghastly Phantom of the Opera. And then later,
so a more sympathy.
Yeah,
so
it's just,
good.
It's still
that,
even.
That to me, you know, and nothing to take away from any of the work that the Germans did. But to me, the most powerful scene, silent era, when it comes to horror, is that scene at the end when the spoilers, people, when the Phantom is cornered by the crowd, and he makes them back off because he moves, he gestures like he's got something, and the crowd just backs off, and then he just reveals that he's got nothing in his hands, and he just laughs at them like. Yeah. He just put one over on him, and of course, that's the last thing he does. But
it's
still,
almost like on purpose. Like, I'm going to humiliate you to where,
because
I'm going to die. I know I'm going to die, and I really want to die. I don't want to like have you guys beat me up and have me live through this because you're going to do a bad job. So he pretends like he's got a bomb in the palm of his hand, and he kind of holds it out towards the crowd. And then he opens his palm. They're all like, and then he opens it up, and there's nothing. He starts laughing at him, and then that crowd just descends on him. Beats the living crap out of him and then dumps him in the river. Dink, the end. That's just it, you know.
It's such a powerful moment because even as an audience member, you're sold. You're like he's got something. You know, this guy is going to like take us all out, and yet it's a great moment. I don't know if it was in the original work or anything like that, but boy, it's something that, like I said, it's probably a scene that I'll never forget it.
Yeah, and the thing is,
I would think. Personally, I think that's the best incarnation of the Phantom of the Opera. Like, there's nothing else that has stood up to that.
Yeah.
Even when I got the Universal Blu-ray set, and I was so bummed when it was the color version. And like, not the silent film. I was like, oh, really? Crap.
That was because that was public domain. The Now, what I've heard is that Universal, even though it would still be technically a public domain, they're going to get a restored copy that they will make theirs. And it's about time. Universal
lets
some of their horror films go, and some of them you're just now hearing about them being restored that should have been never left there with their ownership. And that was one of them. And apparently they're working on a real ultimate restoration of it. But yeah, really horrifying.
That's exciting.
The last face you'd want to see looking in the window at you at night when you're watching TV, seeing something like that, or Nosferatu. It's almost a tie, but I mean, I don't even understand how the heck he came up with that face. It's so ghastly.
Yes.
I mean, yeah. And you don't see anything like that in modern horror, really. I mean, like that, those images are so iconic.
Sure.
I mean, like, you know, you're talking about, you know, Nosferatu. Like, there's one of my favorite bands, it's a punk rock band called Blitzkid, and that's their logo, the Nosferatu face, because it's creepy and they're a horror punk band, and it, you know, it fits in perfectly with their imagery. And like you said, you know, like, people know that even if they haven't seen the movie, they know Nosferatu.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, obviously, and I have to also, just as a side, mention, you know, I now when I think of Max Schreck, I mean, I know it's a little tongue in cheek. It's more of a comedy, but that Shadow of the Vampire movie that came out a few years ago.
I love that movie.
Yeah. With William Dafoe. Perfectly cast. You know, the, you know, I still laugh when I think of him just, you know, sitting there going, I'll eat him later. I don't know what Max Schreck sounds like, but that's what I imagine he sounds like now.
It was a really disturbing movie because he treated his own life like he was just, it was a sickness, like real sickly. And it was a really great interpretation of what would it really like to have been a vampire. Probably not the coolest thing in the world when you're just sitting around. He like grabbed a bat out of the sky and then cracked its neck and then sucked the blood out of its neck or something like that. Yeah. I can't remember exactly what it was, but yeah.
Well, anyway, back to – yeah.
So Chaney Sr. was the king, was the reigning king, and it looked like he was going to move into the position of getting the jobs like playing Dracula and Frankenstein. They had him slated to potentially be that, and then he died. He caught, I don't remember if it was lung cancer or something, he died, and it was a big shock to the world because he was still pretty young, and they had to find people. Well, the beginning of these monster movies and these guys is kind of like the Star Wars Close Encounters of its time period. You've got Dracula in 1931 in the middle of the year, and then you've got Frankenstein closer to the end of the year, and it was almost like that double whammy of two films of that type creating a sensation that made a whole bunch of films come like that after, just like Star Wars and Close Encounters did.
And since they later connected, it's really akin to what Marvel's doing.
Yes, exactly. And so they finally ended up picking the guy that had been playing him on stage, the stage play, and they filmed it more closely to the stage play than the book by a lot. I mean, yes. You know that, Mike. You've read the original novel, and it's quite a bit different. But they decided to pick the guy, the Hungarian, who would unfortunately do it cheaper too than some of the other people that wanted to do it. But it made him a extremely famous person and an icon. And I hate to use this in a negative way, but a stereotype of what Dracula is that still to this day is probably the most famous version of what people think Dracula looks and sounds like, as Bela Lugosi.
Yeah. And I know that, you know, if you, you know, those of us who've read the novel, I mean, Bela's not the guy that you think of. I mean, he's against the type. And the Spanish version that was done at night, filmed consecutively while they were doing that, I mean, that actor probably has a little bit more similarity to what, you know, you kind of picture in the book. He's certainly a lot more romantic. But yet, I mean, I know that Bela sometimes gets a little bit of heat, but I think that he owns it in the movie.
Yes.
And the scene where he says, you know, children of the night, you know, it's just, it's chilling. It's been sampled
so many times. Here's the thing, though.
People look at that film and they go, it's slow. And his voice is weird. And the sound, and there's no music. Okay, got it. But if you filmed it again, let's say you took that exact film and never shown it to anybody and said, David Lynch presents Dracula. And you showed this to them and said, David Lynch directed this. They'll be going, oh, my God. Oh, my God, this is so cool. This is unbelievable. The way that Dracula looks at you too long and the pauses are too long. I think it is a masterpiece. It's actually one of my very, very favorite movies. I watch it at least 4 or 5 times a year. And even with that slow pacing, I don't think it's slow at all. I mean, just the whole fact that he is just, ew, the guy's looking at you like for that extra 2 or 3 seconds. And it's like, what a perv. But it's a really cool movie, and it's really weird. I remember I was always a Frankenstein guy for so many decades, and then one day I found myself watching that one so much more, and I said, well, I love this one as much, if not more, than some of the others. So great movie. But then what happened right after that, and they thought that Lugosi might have played the Frankenstein monster, but it didn't happen. There was another director slated to do it, and he put on some makeup, which I heard was absolutely ludicrous, like a big afro and weird makeup, and he did all this. He did his own makeup, and it was supposed to be like this really bizarre, like giant wig that he had on, and it was laughable. And so they ended up going with Boris Karloff. They got a different director, James Whale, and Lugosi would go on to do Murders in the Rue Morgue, which I really love, but it did have a weird wig in it again. And but Karloff came along. He got this job. The guy saw him in the commissary and gave it to this guy who really was, and a lot of people just say, he is the king. It's like, yes, what Elvis says. Karloff is the king, and there's other people coming in and saying that there's others that are better. But really, if everybody remembered how huge he was for doing that, and his career went a lot better than Bella's did, you know, and that's unfortunate for Bella, but for many,
I'd say his life went better.
Yes, and his, and he, I mean, basically Karloff went from a starving guy who was painfully thin and went all the way up and worked all the way up until like the year that he died, making films, you know, two or three films in the last year or two of his life. And he, one thing that was smart about him that I think some of these people do that I don't agree with is they go, oh man, that thing, why am I always stuck to that? But Boris Karloff always said, well, what do you think about the Frankenstein monster? And he said, yeah, the old boy was good to me. I mean, I lived, I ate, I raised a family, I had fame, I was able to do things, I have a beautiful home and a flower garden. I was able to do it because of this role I took. So I'm not going to complain about it.
He was really smart about it too. I mean, he played the monster twice. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he was able to use that to navigate a role on Broadway that was kind of using that, Arsenic and Old Lace,
yes,
using that kind of image.
Yeah.
And then when they went to film it, he said, no, I'm not going to do that because he didn't want to, you know, he didn't want that on screen. But then he returned to the Dracula franchise.
No, he had another commitment. He would have done it. He had another commitment on. He was still working on a play and he didn't have time. But yeah, he would have done it.
When he returns to the Frankenstein franchise, the Universal franchise, he's like, I'm not going to play the monster anymore.
He played him three times.
Yeah,
he played him three times total. And it was Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, and Son of Frankenstein, which is like, I love it. It's like a rock and roll album. It's great. It's like he's got the giant vest. You can tell Karloff's been eating good. He's been eating that steak at night. He's gigantic.
But then he comes back in House of Frankenstein, but he's a different, like he's a mad scientist, right?
Yeah, yeah. Those movies, we kind of talked about those last week or two, and they're not as good. It was near the end of the Universal.
No, but it's fun watching him. I mean, he's excellent.
And
any of those movies, I mean, he was not, you're right, he's not afraid to come back to what paid his way, you know, and what opened the door. Like, he'll do horror movies. And as bad as some of those are, he still puts in a great performance and sells it. Like,
he did a whole bunch of, he did a run of mad scientist movies. There were really cool ones. Like, they'd go like The Man They Could Not Hang. And he had a mechanical heart that he had brought him back to life. And then he starts killing everybody that had, had him hang in the, you know, because he was doing things against science or against.
What's the one where he's on an island?
Oh, shoot. Isle of the Dead, I think.
That's a good one, too.
But there's a whole bunch of those. And one of the great ones, because we are kind of moving fast through this stuff, is about halfway through his career, he did one, The Body Snatcher, would be directed by Robert Wise, who would end up directing a lot of our favorite movies. But his performance in that, and Bela Lugosi's, too. I mean, because Karloff, there used to be this thing that Karloff and Lugosi had a rivalry, and but later that was debunked. I mean, it's fun to watch it and Ed Wood and things like that, but if you go back and think about it, I mean, Bela Lugosi, we go back to Son of Frankenstein, played Igor, and that actually turned out to be, according to his son, his favorite role that he ever did.
He had a lot. You could tell he had a lot of fun playing Igor.
Oh, he had gotten to do comedy, and he was weird, and he had gotten really good. People always said Lugosi wasn't a good of an actor. I beg to differ. Around that time when he got laid back, man, and Igor is easily one of his greatest performances, especially in that film. He'd play him, I think, one more time after that, or maybe twice. You know, but Lugosi, you know, and some of that was that they were going to rip Lugosi off on his paycheck for playing Igor, and Karloff said, you know, you're not doing that. You know, you're not doing that to him. And so it was.
And that was really good because, you know, Karloff probably didn't need the money near as much as Lugosi did at that point because.
Yeah. These guys were big, and then they did pretty good. And then the 40s came on. We got up close to World War II, and their stuff had kind of started to fade. But then what happened is they re-released Frankenstein and Dracula on a double bill, and everybody went nuts. I mean, it was like it had been reopened for the first time again, a double feature of this stuff, and it made so much money that the guys at Universal, the bean counter, said, hey, we need to start this back up. So they started talking about that, and they did like Son of Frankenstein, but then their newest star, they dusted him off, and that was Lon Chaney Jr. with The Wolfman, which is another super classic that they did. The music was it had been perfected, and there was a pacing to it that was a little more, moved at a quicker pace. And everything, and Chaney became their new star. I mean, Karloff would still work with him, Lugosi, a little bit, but Chaney was then the Wolfman. He played the Frankenstein monster once. There was a time that him and Lugosi did Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, where originally they were trying to figure out how to get Chaney to play both parts because he had just played the Frankenstein monster and he played the Wolfman, and they're like, well, we got to get him to do both parts. And the guy goes, how the hell are you going to do that? So they gave it to Lugosi because Lugosi's brain had been put in – Igor's yeah. brain had been put into his body at the end of the one film. They said, well, let's just have Lugosi do it. It's a fun movie. I love it more. There are some – a few problems with it, and partially people don't realize that the Frankenstein monster in that movie is supposed to be blind, and they cut that out. And there was parts where he was talking, and they cut all that out. But so Chaney Jr. was – the hero of the horror star of the 1940s, with Karloff still doing his thing. His star didn't fade, and
he was the only one that out of them that kept coming back and playing the original role. Like Dracula had come back in a few, but then they had recast Dracula. Yeah. They recast the Frankenstein Carradine. Monster. They recast Frankenstein the scientist. But every time in those Universal movies, every time you see the Wolfman, it's always Lon Chaney Jr.
Yeah, it always had to be
Lon Chaney. I don't know this, but do you know if nowadays, if you have an iconic character like Batman, Superman, when they change the actor, it's a big deal and a lot of people are very negative about it. Yeah. Do you know if that was an issue back then?
I don't think – I don't know as much. I think that they expected a little bit of connectivity, but I think if you look even – we even joke about the fact that even in the 60s, they changed Blofeld out on every James Bond film and nobody seemed to notice. Like one time he'd have hair, one time he was bald, one time he had a slash running down his face. They'd go, yep, that's Blofeld, because I guess they thought people were – people aren't like us. They're not anal like we are nowadays, poring over each little piece of information for nutrients.
Well, and they're just looking to be entertained.
I also think too, I mean, the 30s and the 40s are still pretty, I mean, it's still pretty new as a medium. Yeah. And most of the entertainment people got from either theater or radio. And I think especially in theater, they're used to, people coming in playing the same part, different people. Like, you got accepting. Different people. Yeah. Coming in playing.
That's
Hamlet
a good
all
point.
The time. And I think that they didn't really get, I don't think they got up as hung up on it as they do now, but yeah.
Well, think about it. You're at home, you're Mike Gordon, you've been transported back to the 1930s, and you're like a little kid, and you go, okay, tonight you're going to hear the shadow on the radio.
I'm buying Action Comics number one. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah, I know. I figured that was going to happen.
I'm buying 10 of them.
But you're there. and you're the radio show, and it's like, well, Mom, what am I going to do now? The radio show's over with. Well, go read a book. So you go read a book, and you go to school the next day, and this goes on for like 5 days. Then it's the weekend, and then this Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, and you go, hey, wait a minute, Karloff's not playing the monster. To hell with this. I don't think so. You know what I mean? It's not going to be
spoiled
like,
now.
I'm going to buy Nickelback.
Yeah, really. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where we've got the DVDs and Blu-rays and all that kind of stuff. And, but back then I think they were excited because you could still use the name Lugosi as it was a brand name for horror. So it was different. But later they really tried to get Chaney Jr. to do so much. He played in Son of Dracula, the one where they got the old famous Alucard means Dracula when you say it backwards kind of thing. And he was the Wolfman and he was the Frankenstein monster. And he kind of covered a lot of territory and he was busy. But I think the thing with him, his life, like Lugosi's, was kind of cut a little bit more short in terms of having big roles because he drank real pretty heavily. And by the 50s, it really showed. I mean, there was stuff with him on live television supposed to be the Frankenstein monster, and he grabbed a chair, and instead of throwing it across the room, he'd throw it, looked like he's getting ready to throw it, and put it down very gently because he thought he was still rehearsing. that's how bad he was. He was so drunk. And that went out on live television. I've told that story before, but you can actually see it up online where he's supposed to be trashing the lab, and he's not. He picks the chair up, raises it over his head, and then gently sits it back down. Then he goes over to a table, picks it up, same thing over and over again. And somebody said, yeah, he was so drunk he thought he was still rehearsing. He didn't know it was going out on live television. So, and Lugosi, of course, you know, had the thing with the drugs and all that, painkillers and stuff like that. And you know, we still love them. We love those people, but their late lives kind of, you know, didn't go out on top. Now, Chaney Jr. would get some other stuff like great scenes like in the Defiant ones with Tony Curtis's Sidney Poitier as another escaped convict, and they would get little pieces of juice, and Bella did here and there too. But the other people from that time period that kind of, you know, racing by, you just don't want to forget them. Dwight Frye as the Mad Assistants and all those movies, and Dracula's Helper was, I mean, he was so huge amongst the fans that you know, Alice Cooper wrote a song about him called The Ballad of Dwight Frye, and he was always playing like maniacs or hunchbacks and stuff. Peter Lorre, who was really famous at first for being in Fritz Lang's M as the child killer, and then doing lots of different films later, anything, and especially in the 60s, he seemed to kind of actually ramp up a little bit in the 60s. And then other guys, like
even in the days where, like in the 30s and 40s, though, when he's doing like the crime noir stuff and Casablanca and all that kind of stuff, there's still an element to Peter Lorre that is creepy. Like, like he really can sell that. And I, you know, I've seen him in interviews and stuff like that, and he seems like a really nice guy. But you know, working like I think he didn't go much in the monster route until much later.
Yeah,
But yeah, he was doing all the crime stuff, and still that had that presence, though.
Well, the one that he was most famous, there was a couple of them. One of them was Mad Love, where he was the insane guy with the guy's wife, the surgeon. It's a great film. You have to see it. And he did a little bit. It kind of got stuck with it a little bit. But you're right. Most of his stuff was crime noir. And he had that kind of voice that would be sort of like, you know, it was almost like he was cast against type for the movie M. Fritz Lang wanted somebody who said that person doesn't look like they would kill a child. And so they picked the roundest faced looking, innocent looking guy, but his acting chops were incredible. He was great in the film. But yeah, there was other people like Lionel Atwill, who was, you know, the professor in movies getting his arm torn off by the Frankenstein monster. And John Carradine, as we talked about earlier, he had picked up kind of the role of Dracula until Lugosi came back with Chaney. And with Glenn Strange, who now had kind of become the official Frankenstein, and a good-looking Frankenstein. He looked good. He had a real sleepy kind of a face. But he wasn't necessarily a great actor. He just was really good being this icon of the Frankenstein monster. Karloff was easily the best actor in the Frankenstein costume by far. But
the most iconic, too. If you think about Frankenstein, you know, you think Karloff.
Yeah, and Glenn Strange looks really cool, and he's the one that you see on all the model kits and all the toy boxes and the T-shirts. Mm-hmm. But he's fun, and in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, all that stuff comes to a head with a good, great balance between, oddly enough, comedy and horror, where the mixture just works. It's hard to describe.
That movie's so good.
It is so
That's
good.
It's like a must-watch, like several times a year.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is that if you went through AFI's top 100 film comedies, they did the comedies, the crime, and all that. It was in the top 10 out of the top 100 comedies of all time. That's a really high place to be. And you know what? I still rank it out there as one of the 10 funniest films I've ever seen. And it never gets old. But
that kind of humor is timeless.
Yeah, and the
always be funny.
Yeah, and the monsters are serious. The only one time they break characters when the Frankenstein turns around and looks at Lou and goes, you know, because he thinks he's so ugly, which was a good twist. But so then, but other people that were getting a little bit of a name for being in horror and actually turned out to be true later more was like in Son of Frankenstein, Basil Rathbone playing the scientist, and a couple of gothics that he played like with Karloff, and then Vincent Price. And then we get to Vincent Price, who at the same time that Hammer was doing their Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing are their kings, in Britain with what they were doing, other people like Michael Gough and stuff like that. But then in the United States, especially in the 60s, because everybody acts like Vincent Price was a horror film star all of his life, he only made like 20 or 30 horror films. I mean, there was another 100 or so that he made that weren't.
Right.
And he came in and he did really good with like the Roger Corman, Vincent Price movies, Edgar Allan Poe stuff was excellent, and he was very good. And they were done on such tiny budgets, but you had people in the background like Richard Matheson working on it and stuff. And they would shoot them like in a week, you know, maybe if they were lucky. And then you move to Dr. Fibes, and you move to Theater of Blood and Madhouse, and he kind of became the Prince of Terror. I mean, people tried to say that he was the biggest, but I don't think anybody ever got to the level that Karloff got to. I mean, Karloff got so big that they didn't even use his first name for years. They just said Karloff.
Right.
And they didn't even. But Vincent Price got really huge, and you know, I go to the conventions, and people rave about him. You know, I mean,
absolutely.
So
he had that. You know, he definitely had that style, and that you know,
the voice.
The voice, and he sold it. You know, I mean, I think, you know, we're talking about, you know, the men, but and there's going to be. I'm sure there's women too, but. You know, the key to this is to sell it and to really just get behind it. And I think that's one of the reasons why Karloff, to me, when I see his Frankenstein monster, it just there's something there where it's more sympathetic.
Yes.
Than in any of the others that I've seen.
He's not an automaton.
Right. He's not, he doesn't feel like a moving dead body. He really feels like like a wounded animal that you feel sorry for.
Right. Think about this. Karloff, Basil Rathbone, Vincent Price, Peter Cushing. What makes them great is the fact that they don't, all the great horror actors don't yell. There's no yelling there. There's no, I'm going to kill you. There's none of that kind of crap.
Right.
It's all sort of like, yes, go ahead and come on in here into the parlor. You know, it's like, it's almost like their voice is like melting butter. And Vincent Price was the best at it. I mean, it was so, you know, in the back of
his
your mind.
His laugh is probably,
it's iconic.
I was going to say, there's a reason that Michael Jackson used it for Thriller, you know, and Thriller hit. Is probably one of the biggest hits, not just because of Michael Jackson, but because of Vincent Price on it.
But you got to understand, Michael Jackson picked that up from Alice Cooper, who used him in Black Widow. I mean, Vincent Price had already been doing rock albums. Matter of fact, on ABC, about a decade before, did a nighttime 11:30 at night special with Alice Cooper called Welcome to My Nightmare, and it was him and Vincent Price doing this show. Live on video, or not live, but it was on videotape with him doing basically pre-MTV videos, and he's a horror film fanatic. Alice Cooper is, so he brought him on,
right?
And it works, you know.
One thing I got to so we're getting to the Hammer stuff, and it's important, I think, to stop right now before we get to Hammer, because. The original Frankenstein and Dracula are being circulated in the theaters and then on television, like so much so that nobody can touch these actors when it comes to Dracula and Frankenstein's monsters. Mm-hmm. It's Bela and it's Karloff, and it's these two guys, Lugosi and Karloff. Like, those are the two iconic figures that, even though there are attempts during this time to bring the Dracula and Frankenstein's monster to life, they just fail miserably because of these two iconic guys. So then you get to Hammer, and Hammer's the first company that really makes, in my opinion, an effort to remake these in a different way and in a serious way, and actually succeeds to an extent where nowadays constantly argue the debate more than anybody else is between like Christopher Lee and Bela Lugosi.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, actually, I've seen them debate at like 5 or 6 different people. But yeah, those are two of the first ones that'll come up. And it's interesting because everybody's standing there. It's England. It's 1957. People are walking. They'd already seen the Curse of Frankenstein, and they were startled by it already, by the way. Christopher Lee is so gnashed up and violent.
Yes.
But the real one, this is once again that double whammy that cements them, is Frankenstein, and then the very next year, their version of Dracula. And so all these people go into the movie theater and they're like, okay, we're going to watch Dracula. We're going to ready for blah, blah, I'm going to drink your blood. Well, they go and
speak.
You go in. Well, you know, you go in and sit down. And the Harker shows up at the castle, and Dracula comes down the stairs and he's speaking the Queen's.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
He just comes and goes, good evening. My name is Count Dracula. Everybody in the theater, I mean, I've heard this from so many different people. They were so put off. It's like, what? The guy's just talking regular Queen's English. And then he talks to me, oh, your wife is charming. This is beautiful. Your fiance is charming. She's beautiful. And then it goes along for a little bit. And all of a sudden, this woman appears and goes, oh, I've been kept prisoner here. And he goes, well, I'll help you get away. And she goes to bite his neck. He pushes her away. And all of a sudden, the door kicks open across the hall. And all of a sudden, Terrence Fisher just must have put a fisheye lens on Christopher Lee and just said, look, just go completely psychopathic in front of them. And he just goes, bah! And they said everybody in that theater just freaked. Technicolor blood, like the kind of color that you should see on a beautiful musical, a MGM musical, but it's not. It's got blood, it's got fangs, it's got glowing red eyes. And then Christopher Lee comes in and does basically his two best minutes of Dracula that he ever did, throttling the guy, throwing him to the floor, and dragging the woman out. You know, and just taking her off, you know, to kill her or make her submit or whatever. But it was just, and the audience was in shock. They were in shock. And Hammer knew they had won. They knew they had it.
Yeah.
And then you had other people come in, like Oliver Reed, who's already a werewolf. You don't even have to put makeup on him. In Curse of the Werewolf, he's so scary. Oliver Reed was a rough dude, and you put him in putting him in werewolf makeup was a natural choice. And there was a few other people that were really good that worked. There were quite a few other people that worked with Hammer, but Cushing and Lee were their big stars.
Yeah.
Other people would come later, like Ingrid Pitt. And some of the ladies of Hammer and stuff, all really good actresses and actors, very polished and professional on a very small budget. And they made a good product.
So now let's okay. So after Hammer, we go into, I don't know. I'm old because I want to call it the modern era, but it's not the modern era.
It's Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist is the
exactly.
Game changers.
It's right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean.
But, Linda Blair, I mean, it's weird to call her like a monster man, but she did really sell that as well.
Actors were now moving out of being typecast, and Ellen Burstyn and all the actors in that film would make so many other movies that were not horror related. You don't consider Ellen Burstyn to be a horror actress,
right?
But in that film, it was so unbelievable what was going on in that movie at the time. And then Linda Blair, as this little girl going through all this hellacious stuff.
And in The Omen, the monster's a baby, so it's yeah. This little kid or whatever. So
that's the first horror movie I ever saw, and my dad is a horrible parent because that movie is so fucked up.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, it really is. But
Amoebia, yeah, but you're right. It is. I mean, it's one of the. I read the book before I saw the film because my parents were like, that's R-rated. You're not going. So I got the paper back and I read it, and I read it and go, man, it's up. I mean, so
yeah, it is. Yeah. And it's weird. Like my dad was always like, you know, the one movie he wouldn't let me watch was Hellraiser for some reason, but yeah. I could watch everything else. Like we watched The Exorcist and The Omen and Rosemary's Baby. And I'm like 7, you know, and I'm like, holy shit, this is so, so bad. But like, he always told me you can't watch Hellraiser. And then I finally watched it like when I was like 18 and I was like, it's not that bad. It's good.
Yeah,
but I don't, those other movies were way more messed up.
So, yeah, because you get a lot of psychological, spiritual, religious horror movies coming out in the 70s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah.
Growing up as a Southern Baptist and hearing about all that stuff, like it's real, it's like, oh, God, you know, it's frightening.
yeah, they're not really monster, like they're not monsters in the traditional sense that we've been talking about now. I mean, you know, in the 30s, the 40s, 30s, et cetera. So
this is big, expensive Hollywood focusing on it and knowing that the religious issues, the religious aspect of it is pushing some buttons and some deep primal fears in some people. So I knew people who would not go to see The Exorcist because of the subject matter and they never did see it, you know.
But so. on the other hand, you do have this wave that I think is inspired by Hitchcock's Psycho, where now you've got actors playing serial killers, and that's a different kind of monster that we had kind of seen before, but not. I mean, these were guys that, you know, would blend in and be you surprised. I mean, obviously Norman Bates is a perfect example of, you know, you have no idea what's coming. If you've never seen or heard about Psycho before, because that's kind of tough these days. But if you have no clue, I mean, you know, Nice Boy, you don't even after the killings start, you don't think it's him. You know, you think it's
even up until the end when he's talking about I wouldn't hurt a fly. Like that's, you know, Anthony Perkins did such a good job of that role. I mean, he was so unassuming and so creepy, but also like you're like, this guy, you know, he's just misunderstood, you know. That's how you feel about him. And you know, he's also kind of a murderer. So,
and I think that's sort of the granddaddy of, like, you know, later when we get to the late 70s and in the 80s into the slasher movies.
The only film that came out before Psycho would have been Peeping Tom, which was almost the exact same time. And that's a real wild film created by a great movie director in England who basically had made a bunch of famous English films that are revered as like some of their greatest. And then he made this and he made this film and it kind of like it damn near destroyed his career. I mean, it was almost like where the guy's using a tripod with a sharp end on one of the legs, and he's photographing the women's faces while he's pushing the tripod leg into them. Yeah. And that was I think I want to say it was either the same year as Psycho or just before it, but it was so close that that it wasn't like he ripped off Psycho. But that one got banned for many years, and finally Martin Scorsese and Coppola and them said, "You got to dust it off. We got to restore it," and they finally put it out. But yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say, before we move on past The Exorcist, I just had to say, me and Sean Reed, my girlfriend Nicole, just went, Sean, you know him, Rav Ranger, Radical Radcast. But we just got back from Halloween Horror Nights in Universal Studios. They actually had an Exorcist haunted house. And that was insane. I mean, like, you know, to a normal person, you know, they're like, oh, this is creepy. But like, it was so cool because you actually walk up to the house. And when you walk out, like, you're under the streetlight, you know, like the famous streetlight.
Wow.
You're looking out the window.
Wow.
And it was so cool. And then, we walked.
Oh, man.
It was so – it gave me chills.
They got Tubular Bells playing in the speakers.
They did. Yeah, like very faintly in the background. Yeah. And we walk up to the house, and we go into the house, and, you know, it starts out with the Pazuzu, I think is what it's called, the demon thing, idol.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And you see little glimpses of Captain Howdy's face, you know, coming out, and you're like, oh, okay, this is kind of creepy. And then you walk into the bedroom and, like, you know, stuff's just getting started. Of course, they also had the infamous staircase scene in there too. But like the cool thing was you kept going back through the bedroom, like you would walk through a different part of the house and then back through the bedroom. And each time it would escalate. So it would get more horrifying and horrific and like disturbing as you went along. So like, you know, it's like, oh, what's happening now? Oh, Linda Blair's spinning her head, and now she's throwing up on, you know, the priest. And it was so cool. It was like reliving the movie.
Wow.
So I mean, there's only a few days left, but you should totally check it out.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I'll check it out this year. Hopefully it'll be something you put up again next year, but I would go see that. That's for sure.
It's always good because they also did American Werewolf in London. And, you know, like they actually like had you walk into the slaughtered lamb in the very first part of the haunted house. And it was so cool. One of my friends actually snuck a beer in there just so he could drink a beer in the slaughtered lamb.
Cool. So we get the slasher movies, and no offense to any of the great actors that played Michael or Jason or any of the other psychos that we, you know, the sort of psycho men the unstoppable guys that laid waste to a lot of teenagers in those movies. I don't think we really get an actor really, you know, coveting the monster role until Freddy.
Yeah, Freddy's the one. That's probably the only.
He's the one that you couldn't change out. Every other one they changed out, and yeah. He's the one that you couldn't change actors. Like, they tried in the remake, and it was god awful. You can't. Yeah. I mean, Robert Englund is Freddy. That's just all there is to it.
Yeah, there was a wink in his eye even when he was doing really nasty stuff. And it's weird. I mean, I don't really look at Nightmare on Elm Street as being a slasher film. There's too much inventiveness in the dream aspects of it, the clever ways that they're killing people, as opposed to a slasher goes to Lowe's and looks at the power tools and goes, what have I not used yet? And then he purchases it, and then he goes and he hits somebody in the head with the new machete he just got or whatever. Maybe weed whack him to death. I don't know. But with Freddy, it was always stuff. And some of the stuff, like I had said before on this show, there was aspects to it that I had actually had dreams similar to those as a child. Like Freddy walking down the alley with his arms stretched out super long with his claws dragging along the sides of the window. I'd actually had that dream. Not with Freddy. It was another figure, like a blue-faced guy or something. And it was like, and when I saw the film, I'm like, God, they're really like going after, you know, probably what Rod Serling did, writing this stuff down, waking up from a nightmare and jotting down what happened and then going back to sleep. And the Freddy stuff, I mean, that's not all those films were great. They had some stinkers in there, but some of them were really good, especially the first one. And I think I remember, was it another odd or even thing with that film
series? Yeah, one is amazing. Three is actually really good. The Dream Warriors. That's where a lot of the iconic stuff comes from, like the puppet and the syringes and the Welcome to Primetime Bitch.
Right.
Like all that stuff comes from that one. Two is very odd, and it's gotten worse over time.
Yeah, I heard it's worse. I heard.
I always think of though with as bad as two is. The opening with the school bus really freaks me out. Like that's like really.
Annoying. Yeah, that's a good scene.
Yeah.
And there's good stuff in it. It has like a lot of like the plot's really weak and the main actor's really, you know, I'm sorry. I know that dude's been through a lot. I can't remember his name, but he was not good for that role. You know, after the first one was just so good, he was terrible. So, but that being said, they came back strong with Dream Warriors, and it's got a Dawkins song that's kick ass. So I'm down with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the thing about it though, and I think it's what harkens back to a lot of the greats that we would mention is that, you know, obviously you've got the look, you've got the fedora, you've got the sweater, you've got the glove with the blades on it. But really, when you look at the makeup that Robert Englund has, I mean, yes, it's pretty gross, but really, like, if you take off your glasses, it's almost like that's just him. Like you can't really, like, it's, I mean, they really did a good job. And I think that's the important thing, too, when we're talking about Monster Man, is when you hire great actors to do it, let us see them. Like, because
you want to see them through the makeup.
Absolutely. Because we want the makeup to just, you know, bring out their characteristics rather than hide them.
Right.
Whereas Michael Myers, the reason he's so scary is you never see what he looks like.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. There's,
that's
yes,
what's well, scary about him. So there's a time and a place, but for Monster Man, you're totally
absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. Because because you're right. Because both Jason and Michael Myers have their, you know, their place as characters. Mm-hmm. But as far as actors goes, I mean, yes. I mean, like I said, no offense to anybody, but it's difficult to tell who's who in a lot of those movies.
Yeah, it's their presence. It's they're already an icon. You come right out. You've got the second or third film where he finally put on a hockey mask, where Jason put on a hockey mask and used
that third,
on. Third one, and then Mike Myers always looking like William Shatner with drained of blood. But I mean, and you know, the thing is that I'm not a huge fan of those. I went and saw them as a kid. I was like, you know, I got to go face the dragon. I got to go see if I can sit through this movie and not be too scared. And then after a while, I got kind of bored with them. I preferred the Freddy. I think that later when they came back with like Scream, I thought that first – I never watched anything beyond the first one, but I thought that first one was
good. That's a good call.
I think
the first one's really good.
I think Wes Craven was extremely talented, and I think that he could make ones – even one of his that would normally not even be that good was at least watchable. You know, like if Wes Craven made a bad movie, at least it was like, oh, I could still watch it. But
at least the premise, at least you could tell he was trying to do something.
Like,
at least it wasn't
shocker.
Yeah, I mean, it might have failed to some extent, but at least he was trying to push something.
Now, the only person that I can even think of nowadays that would have been considered a horror actor just because he kind of gravitated towards the roles, but he was also known for so much other stuff. But he's the one person that I can almost look at and go, well, he's got such a repertoire of horror under his belt and weird stuff, was Jack Nicholson. Jack Nicholson actually yes. did The Joker. He did The Shining. He did Wolf. He did, you know, he did Tim Burton stuff. He did these different things. And but we all know that he also did a whole bunch of other stuff that wasn't horror related. You know, he did Terms of Endearment yeah. and Hoffa and all these other movies. And he's great. But he's almost already a horror film by himself. That you almost it's almost like, you know, a lot of films could be considered horrific because he's in them. Not that's a great compliment to him too. He's one of my all time favorite actors.
Yeah.
But you look at The Shining, and then you even see glimpses of that same kind of character in other films, and it's like, man, that is so under the surface with him, where he's about ready to lose it. And that performance alone is so iconic. Everybody knows where the term "Here's Johnny" came from was Johnny Carson. But you say "Here's Johnny" nowadays, and everybody knows it's Jack Nicholson making fun of Johnny Carson. It's the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
But I'm absolutely a massive fan of Jack Nicholson.
Real quick before we wrap up, Ryan, is there anybody of note that that we didn't get to?
Yeah, I definitely want to give I definitely want to give Sid Haig some credit.
Oh, especially, yes. You know, absolutely.
I mean, I think he's so iconic in his role, and he's so, you know, so talented and like so memorable, all of his performances. Yeah. And obviously, you know, he's also done non-horror stuff, but he's definitely known for the horror scene.
I'm watching Diamonds Are Forever the other day and didn't realize he was one of the gangsters. I had a brother once, and Sean Connery goes, small world. I mean, it's like I couldn't believe it. I said, that's Sid Haig? But yeah, I mean, he and you think about how long he has been around. I mean, he was making films like all the way back in the early 60s and stuff, you know. So
he's still a rock star at these cons, man. You know, you get a horror con and like that dude's just – his table's always swarmed. It doesn't matter, you know. People are just getting like, you know, multiple things signed from him, you know. Like, hey, I know I've seen you at 7 other cons, but, you know – sign this Captain Spaulding action figure, you know. The guy's just a rock star when it comes to conventions, you know.
Yeah, I can't remember.
And I think Bill Moseley as well.
Yeah, I think I saw him. I think I was watching Jackie Brown, and he played a judge in Jackie Brown.
Yep.
I mean, he's one of those people that's been with us so long. He's part of our DNA, and when he pops up, it's like, oh, my God, you know, you can't believe it.
Yeah, I think just recently I saw him in the Kurt Russell Western kind of horror movie.
Bone
Tomahawk. Yeah.
Oh man, what
excellent!
I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah. You need to have that.
It's a rough ride, man.
And I mean, I think you also, you know, we got to mention Angus Scrimm. You know, I haven't seen Ravager yet, but I heard it's a really good performance from him. I've heard the movie has problems, but you know, it's his last performance. I heard it was amazing. But the tall man he's terrifying.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
I met him years ago at a Famous Monsters convention. He's a sweetheart. He was always real grateful about, you know, so I came to the country and I got a job in the movies and people, I've got friends from it and people that love me. And it's like, hey, man, you know, he got the American dream, you know? But,
well, excellent, guys. I think we've jammed in a lot more than I thought we could. So it has been awesome to talk about. I'm sure there's some Monster Men that we've missed. So for those listeners out there who want to slap a wrist, please let us know on the Facebook page or contact us and let us know who your favorite monster person is. Monster Man, Monster. We didn't get a chance to mention a lot of women, but we did sort of last week on Scream Queens. So that's pretty good. But thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Oh, man. No problem. Thank you
very much. Absolutely.
Welcome to A Geek Girl's Take. I'm your host, Angela. And this week, this geek girl is talking about female directors in the fandom genres. This is the age of the geek genre, and with that age comes a lot of really awesome opportunities for all the fans out there, including the ladies. In the last few years, we've seen a surge in females in fandom, and as someone who grew up looking for ladies that were creating in the genre that I loved, this makes me really happy. And as a female who has directed short films, this is one topic that is very dear to my heart. we got the news that the second season of Jessica Jones will be directed by all females, which is amazing. The first season was great and showed how a female-led superhero show would work, and now we get to see how all different types of lady directors will take that character in season two. It is even cooler since some of these ladies have never done episodic shows before. We also have the wonderful female director doing a lot for the CW and BBC, Rachel Talalay. She's directed Supergirl, Doctor Who, Sherlock, and she's also posted that she's working on The Flash right now. If you do not know who Rachel Talalay is, you should look her up. She has a really impressive resume and is also really awesome to talk to if you ever get a chance at a convention. Ladies are popping up in prominent roles in fandom, and it doesn't seem to be stopping, which is great since there need to be more ladies in film that aren't just acting or getting coffee. Thanks for listening to A Geek Girl's Take. What will I talk about next week? Well, you're going to have to listen to find out.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back. Now it's time for the ESO Con Report.
Well, we are getting ready to celebrate Halloween. The countdown is over. And in doing so, there's some events coming up that you can find myself at anyway, as well as some friends of the station, starting with this Thursday. So right after you listen to this, boom, head over to Galactic Quest in Lawrenceville, Georgia, for the acoustic Halloween party. I'm not performing. I'm not singing. So it's safe for everybody. I'm not going to frighten children that way for Halloween.
So no karaoke there for you.
Huh? Exactly. But they've Ricky and Bambi, our good friends from Radio Cult, are going to be putting on performing, as well as some other friends of the station will be there as well. It's going to be a great time. I always enjoy hanging out with them. Their shows are always so much fun. And then I will be at Galactic Quest also on October 28th. That is the Halloween Comic Fest at Galactic Quest in Lawrenceville. If you don't know what the Halloween Comic Fest is, rewind a couple of episodes that we had where I spotlighted it. But really quick, it's basically a chance. It's sort of like Free Comic Book Day, Halloween style. A lot of the publishers put out mini comics that the local comic shops will give out for free. And you'll have to check with your local comic shop as to exactly when they're doing it. Since Halloween is on a Monday, some of the stores are doing it on Saturday. Some are doing it on a Friday night, like Galactic Quest. Some are doing it on Sunday. And some might even be performing or having some sort of event on the Monday itself, on Halloween itself. So call up your local comic shop. Find out what they're doing for Halloween Comic Fest. Odds are they're having some sort of event. They're going to encourage usually they encourage people to come out in costume. Have a great time. Bring the kids. A lot of the comics are kid-friendly, and a lot of times they'll have artists or people like myself who've done indie books to be there to celebrate and celebrate comics and talk about making comics and actually, you know, you can actually buy a copy of Tiki Zombie. Plus, I'll have some of the free comics that I had in May with me as well. So if you do come by Friday night, you will get something for free from me. And then that's pretty much it. I mean, for October, November 13th is the Atlanta Comic Convention, and that is a one-day show that we love so well. It's a great time to get low-price trades, $5 trades, $1 comics, sometimes even quarter bins. Although those are a bit rarer. These days. And of course, you can find pop figures, at least the ones that Mike hasn't already snagged, available as well. It's great fun. A lot of great friends of the station will appear throughout the day. Mike and I don't have a table or whatever. We will be there at various times throughout the day, just kind of hanging out. So if you do intend to meet up with us, which we'd love to chat with you, please reach out to us and let us know you're going to be there, and we'll hook up and say howdy. And then on December 3rd is the Northeast Comic Con and Collectibles Extravaganza. It is in Wilmington, Massachusetts. It is my only appearance in New England this year. I'm super excited to be there. It's going to be a fun show. I'm going to have a very big surprise I'm very excited about this. Very excited that there will be something that making its debut at this show. So watch this or listen to this space for more information about that. But you can find out more information about that, as well as all the convention appearances that we're going to be at on ESONetwork.com. And if you've got a convention that we haven't mentioned yet that you want us to participate in, you want us to help promote, or you just want to rave about, please contact us because we love talking about conventions.
So that's going to wrap up another episode of the Earth Station 1 podcast. I want to thank our guests for being here. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Not a problem. Anytime.
Hey, anything you want to shout out about, sir?
Yeah, absolutely. So, actually, when is this going to air?
Wednesday.
All right, Wednesday. So, yeah, that works perfect. Come see us Thursday at the Claremont Lounge with Captain Maybell and Theme Without a Face. If you don't know about Captain Maybell, they're sideshow performers. You know, they're like, they have an exhibit in Ripley's, believe it or not. They're badass. Totally worth checking out. We're also going to be there too, but we won't be shoving swords down our throat. But, you know, we're still pretty cool. And then we're also playing on Halloween night in Gainesville, Georgia, which if you're in Atlanta, that sounds really far, but I swear it's not that bad. You know, it's like 45 minutes north.
Oh, my God. Outside the perimeter. Ah.
Yeah, it's at this place called Mule Camp Tavern. I call it Mule Camp Arena, but there's like a whole story behind that. But basically, we're playing with Bigfoot, which is an amazing Atlanta band. If you haven't seen them, they're worth seeing regardless anywhere. And Be at the Means, which is another really great band. So that's going to be our big Halloween thing. And obviously, the Catholic Teachers are going to headline that one because that's our big Halloween hurrah. And then, you know, other than that, you know, we've had a good season and we appreciate everything that, you know, everyone's done for us and like come out to the shows. We've had a bigger turnout this season than any season ever. So it's been really good. And, you can check us out on facebook.com/thecasketcreatures. And, yeah, just make sure you, click get notifications and keep up with us.
That is awesome, sir. It's great.
See them.
You back.
See them.
Yeah. We just blew Mike's mind. I was like, honestly, Mike, you like honestly went to the best show of the season because like we just started pulling stuff out of our ass. We're like, hey, let's just play this. It's like it actually works. I'm surprised.
Oh, it's so good.
That is awesome, sir. And Mr. Mark, thank you very, very much for joining us actually tonight and for the past month.
Absolutely, we're gonna miss, man. It.
I appreciate it, guys. You know, I love
it's
my this so time of year.
So fun having you on this time of year. I mean, you know your stuff. That's a given, and it's also just great to hang out and chat with you for four times a month.
Well, I appreciate it. I really do. Let's see. Shout out is that Scream magazine should be on the stands in Barnes & Noble probably in the next week or two, I think. And I'm not allowed to discuss what's on the cover, but I'll give you guys a hint. It is something that we discussed tonight.
And it could be a lot of things.
Well, let me put it this way. You'll find it very interesting.
Ooh, I like it.
And so it's Scream with two E's, S-C-R-E-E-M. And I'm pretty proud of it. I don't normally delve in stuff from that time period, but I'm pretty proud of it. But you'll know it when you see it.
Nice.
And but I can't really say it because it's going to premiere at Chiller, I believe, is where they premiere the magazine, and that's where they sort of talk about it. So that's it.
That is awesome. That is very, very awesome. And of course, Mr. Mike.
As always, it's my pleasure.
And what are you going to shout out about tonight, sir?
I got to shout out to my Cubs, man. They made the World Series. So woo-hoo! I don't know what's going to go on from here because it could be, you know, another it could be either one of the best things to ever happen or it could be another, you know, Halloween nightmare. So we'll just have to go and see what happens there. But I'm rooting for them as always. And I am so proud of that they made it this far.
That is awesome. Yeah. I'm very happy. First time since 1945, the Cubs have been into the World Series.
Yeah, and it's been even much longer since they've won it. So this is this would be a great day for the franchise, great day for baseball, great day for Chicago. I mean, I saw it happen with my American League team, the Red Sox, you know, in 2004. It really can transform things. So you know, I've been waiting for the other shoe to drop for years now. So let's hope it happens.
You know, it's an interesting World Series with the Cleveland Indians and the Chicago Cubs, because neither team have won. I think the Indians, the last time they were in was in the 1960s.
They've been in the World Series.
They've won. They were in the 90s.
Yeah, well.
They've had chances. They beat the first time the Seattle Mariners made it to the American League Finals. The Indians actually beat them. Sad. Oh, well. Well, it's going to be an interesting World Series, so it should be cool to see. My shout out goes to Bob Dylan. Congratulations to Mr. Zimmerman for actually winning the Nobel Prize in Literature. Now, if only they could find him to give him the prize. And that's not a joke.
He's sort of kind of they're miffed at him now because he hasn't acknowledged them. That's apparently what's going on now.
Exactly.
Yeah. But that's the way he's always been. He goes, I always consider myself a bit of a song and dance man. You know, he's like George C. Scott. He doesn't really think too much, I guess, of the awards,
Exactly.
Do your music, man. Be happy.
Yeah, what the award was almost like $900,000. You know, for us, that'd be like, wow.
Oh, I didn't know that part about it. Wait a minute, yeah. Bob. What are you thinking? I didn't know that part.
Oh, yeah, part of the prize.
Feel free to transfer that check over to me. I'll take it off your hands. No problem.
Exactly.
I'll work with it.
Exactly. We'll make it work. We'll split it three ways, you know.
Yeah, really.
Exactly. Although, I got to say one thing to Mike Gordon. We are going to a haunted house sometime. Me and you.
Uh-oh. Thinking of spooky things, that leads us into next week's show, because we're done with the countdown, because by the time our next show comes out, it'll be after Halloween. Yep. But we're not done with the spooky things. We might even be going to Stranger Things.
We're moving from spooky things to Stranger Things.
Exactly.
I love it.
We are going to find out everything about Stranger Things. We're going to talk all about it.
Going to visit the Upside Down.
Oh, yes. We are going to find out all about number 11. We're going to find out all about what happened on the other side. And what's the deal with the slugs? And poor Barb.
Well, I mean, it's traditional. After you know, Halloween's over, you put up your Christmas lights. So this is going to be very appropriate.
Good pull. Nice.
He's been playing that one all week. It's okay. Thank you guys for joining us. Of course, the show is brought to you by the ESOAmazon.com store, where we make it real easy for you to go shopping and help support the station by either going to the store or even now, you can just go to ESOPodcast.com/ESOAmazon. That's all you have to do. Real simple to go to Amazon.com, and every time you do, it helps support the station. So thank you guys so much. We want to hear from you, esopodcast@gmail.com, or call us at 404-963-9057. And if you say something interesting, we will put you up on the air. So with that being said, we will see you next week. My name is Mike Faber. We'll talk to you then. Peace. And we're done.
Is there such thing as like a baby haunt?
A baby haunt.
Like...
Space.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.